This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Baseball's data struggle. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The time between pitches is longer. The time between balls batted into play is longer. Stats are to blame. Hear what baseball might do after the playoffs to try again to speed up games.
Traditional gyms are in a battle with boutique fitness studios over members. Find out the strategies they're rolling out.
The original Blade Runner movie was a curse for a lot of companies whose logos made a cameo in the film. What about the sequel coming out next month?
And even though Ringling Brothers is gone, there is still buzz for the circus industry.
Well, what we found is that there seems to be new life for the circus, and indeed, it's at the state fair level. Really, a fair in New England, the Big E, which is essentially New England State Fair, has kind of led the way with presenting its own circus. But what has happened is now some other state fairs are sort of echoing what the Big E has done.
Wall Street Journal staff writer Charles Pazzi on signs of life in the circus industry. He's here later in the hour. As investigators fill in the details of Stephen Paddock's rampage during a country music festival along the Las Vegas Strip last weekend, doctors, nurses, and paramedics are recounting injuries they say are rarely seen in this country, and even the most veteran of medical pros say it was difficult to process. The Washington Post spoke to some of those at Ground Zero. Here's health reporter Lena Sun. Lena, what have you heard?
There was so much blood that this one trauma nurse was slipping and sliding while she was trying to take care of her patient. And as anybody knows, blood has a smell, and she said the air smelled like iron.
Wow.
So you get a sense of what it was like as these folks tried to triage the patients as quickly as possible, get the sickest people treated, get them in the order of like most critical to least critical, trying to get the supplies, getting pediatric people take care of kids to take care of adults, having obstetricians jump in, and luckily, because there were some Air Force surgeons who were there doing training, the surgeons recognized that a lot of these wounds were more similar to what you see on the battlefield.
Goodness.
And those guys were asked to help.
Wow.
So all hospitals have to deal with these mass, casualty incidents, or they're ready for them. But, obviously they were dealing with so many more here.
Mm-hmm. One line in the story, too, jumps out. You said, your colleagues say, even the hardiest medical professionals acknowledged being rattled. It's almost hard to imagine because we rely on these folks so much.
Right. I think what is going on here is the other thing that your audience might want to know is, these are not just typical gunshot wounds. These are wounds from bullets that were fired at high velocity. So the difference from a bullet that's fired from a typical 9mm handgun is very different from when you're firing with a semi-automatic. The semi-automatic, that bullet travels 3 times faster than the bullet that's fired from a handgun.
Mm.
And, this is physics, right? So the energy of that bullet, if it's stopped in your body, then your body has to absorb all the damage. And one trauma surgeon explained to me, if a 9mm bullet, like from a handgun, hits you in the liver, it might maybe cause a wound maybe an inch wide. But if you're hit in the liver with an AR-15, it would be like dropping a watermelon onto the cement. It just is disintegrated.
Goodness.
So as these bullets travel through your body, it's not just where it goes in and where it comes out. It creates this shock wave as it goes through your body. So it damages the tissue all around it, like spreading out. And when you damage the tissue, you also basically shred all your blood vessels. And then you lose the blood supply to that entire area. And when this bullet exits your body, it's not a little tiny hole. It might be 6 inches wide. Blood is pouring out, and also chunks of flesh and bone. So it is very difficult, as from a surgeon's perspective, to close that wound. You need multiple operations.
Mm.
And then you have the risk of infection because the tissue that's been contaminated, all the blood vessels are dead.
Yeah.
The white blood cells that have to go deal with the immune response can't get there. You know, there's no blood vessel expressway to get there. So there's risk of infection, and that's why it's so serious.
We're speaking with Lena Sun, health reporter at The Washington Post. Her and the team put together a story called As the Wounded Kept Coming, Hospitals Dealt with Injuries Rarely Seen in the U.S., talking about the massacre in Las Vegas Sunday night. In the story, too, it talks about survival generally depends on several factors. Can you explain those?
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, like, where you are, the position of the body when it was hit, how far you are from the weapon, and as I mentioned before, the velocity of the bullet and the type used is very critical, and the location of the entry wound and the path the bullet follows before it exits. You know, it might not exit. So in this case, it was extremely bad for the victims because they were in that open space. They were lying down trying to avoid the gunshot. The guy was shooting from above. The bullet was moving very fast. It's a high velocity, and he had, you know, made up the gun so they could be like automatic. So it was very hard to hide, and you had a lot of direct entry wounds into the body.
Jeez, there were so many coming in at one point. They couldn't even collect patients' info, like even their names, right? They were assigning random names.
Yeah, and then they had tagged people red tag versus green tag, you know, if you're because it was more critical to get them treated and, you know, immediately seen. So red tag meaning that they needed attention immediately. And in one case, my colleagues reported they didn't have enough some supplies to put in like a test tube for this one patient, and she needed it inserted very quickly, and if she didn't have it, she was going to die. And the nurse said that she saw the look of terror in her patient's eye, She told the patient, squeeze my hand, scream, do whatever you need to do, it's going to hurt. But years later, you're going to look back at this, and you're going to be alive.
Can you imagine that scene? It's Washington Post health reporter Lena Sun. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. First full weekend in October. Baseball has never been more beset by inaction. Games this season saw an average gap of 3 minutes 48 seconds between balls put into play by batters, an all-time high. There were more pitcher substitutions than ever, the most time between pitches on record, and longer games than ever. Baseball can be brutal to watch right now. What else can be done to speed up the game? Here's Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. Jared, what do we have?
Well, it's no secret that baseball has a problem with the length of its games. They are getting longer and longer every single year. This season, there's once again a record average length of games, over 3 hours again. This is a problem for baseball, who is continuing to battle losing its audience. Its audience is considerably older than that of the other major sports. And baseball doesn't want that. And it's very hard to get younger people interested in baseball when these games are going till 11:30 at midnight every single night, something we already saw with the Yankees and Twins in the wild card game. The first playoff game went almost 4 hours.
Mm.
There's a lot of reasons as to why this is happening, and most of the conversation has centered around things like commercial breaks and pitchers taking too long to throw and batters stepping out of the box. And all of that is true, but perhaps an even bigger factor, which is what me and my colleague Brian Costa wrote about, is it's the way the game is being taught is just different than it ever was before. The influx of data, the analytics revolution, Moneyball, as it were, something that has really changed the game, has also led to the game being played slower. And that's very difficult for baseball to combat.
Yeah. What about potential changes in the offseason? Is there anything they can do to make an impact, I guess, unlike this year's changes?
So you're going to see some things change for next year for sure. Rob Manfred, MLB's commissioner, has made it clear that he wants to implement a pitch clock next year, so it would require pitchers to throw the ball within a prescribed amount of seconds. That's going to happen. It looks like there'll also probably be changes made to mound visits, how often coaches and players are able to go visit the pitcher out on the mound. That's all well and good, but some of the more radical things that perhaps could be done are still not really being discussed. things like limiting how many relief pitchers can be used in a game or an inning, which is a huge factor as to why games are longer. Teams are using more pitchers now than ever before. That's not going to change. They still aren't talking about things like banning defensive shifts. Another thing that maybe not has made the game longer, but has made the game more boring because there are just fewer balls put in play. There's a lot more strikeouts.
Yeah.
These things are not being discussed, and MLB is very worried about doing anything that's going to fundamentally change the way the game is played from a competition standpoint. That's the balance they're trying to strike.
You know, the idea of a relief pitcher limit is interesting because with that, would you have to introduce a mercy or surrender rule?
I don't know how it would work. I think you just have to force pitchers to stay out there.
Oh, jeez.
You cannot come out of the game and force pitchers like the old days when pitchers used to pitch the whole game. Look, no one's going to say you can't bring in use your pitchers. I think it's more we don't want as many changes in the innings. Innings, another thing that's been discussed perhaps is a relief pitcher comes in during an inning. He doesn't get to warm up. He has to come right out of the bullpen, go to the game mound, and go. That would definitely save some time.
Definitely,
but there are things that could be done, and I think it's imperative that it does, because we cannot have four-hour baseball games. I love baseball more than almost anything on earth, but even I don't want to sit through a four-hour baseball game that ends at midnight.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. How about two? This guy in New Jersey that you wrote about, he flips the TV off at 10 o'clock. If the Mets are still playing, then he says that's too bad. That's too long to be watching.
You know, I admire him. I spoke with a man named Shannon Pryor, who is he's a prominent blogger who's blogged about the Mets for actually almost a decade now. Huge fan. He used to watch every single game, and he became increasingly disillusioned with how the game was played, all the pitching changes. So he said this year, you know what? At 10 p.m. on a weekday, I'm turning the game off. I don't care if the game's still going on. And what he told me was he missed the end of most games. Now, fortunately for him, the Mets were terrible this year, so he didn't miss too many exciting games. But I think that speaks volumes. If a huge fan like him is done, saying, I'm not going to keep watching these games this late, what chance does the sort of casual fan or a child have?
How about, you mentioned child, it made me think of, what about youth interest here? Is that being affected by the pace of play?
Youth interest in baseball has taken a hit, really for a while. There's some signs that's starting to pick back up. Major League Baseball has made huge efforts to try to just improve that. They know that's the future of baseball. If you don't have youth participation, you're not going to have baseball fans moving forward.
All right, thanks, Jared. It's Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. The traditional fitness gym, once the go-to for a good workout, is shifting strategy to compete with the popularity of boutique studios that offer classes like yoga or spin in a group setting. Here's how from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
How do traditional gyms compete with boutique studios? By adding membership options. Tanya Garcia of MarketWatch is here with more. Tanya, why are traditional gyms getting squeezed?
Well, there's become this preference for group classes, and the boutique setting has really taken off as a result. So places like yoga work studios or soul cycle classes, those are things that are really attracting millennials, younger, slightly more affluent, let's say, gym goers. And so the membership style of traditional gyms has just fallen out of favor just a little bit.
Are traditional gyms getting squeezed elsewhere?
I mean, they're getting squeezed in the sense that real estate is an issue for them. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the membership issue and the subscription style of payment that they're expecting from their members. And then on the other hand, a traditional gym is a big space, lots of equipment, in addition to the studios where they're offering different sorts of classes. A boutique, they can do everything in a small space and with less equipment. So there's a lot of different expenditures that traditional gyms have to work around.
So traditional gyms generally are paying much higher rents?
Generally speaking, they would, just for the bigger space. So, I mean, of course, that's location specific. If you're in New York, perhaps the rent would be different from someplace elsewhere in the country. But generally speaking, if you need, you know, let's say, a couple thousand square feet of space in order to fit in your treadmills and your weights in addition to your studios, that's quite different from a studio that's only servicing yoga classes, where all you need is just a big wide open space and maybe a small, you know, changing area.
Tanya, what's the appeal of boutique fitness studios?
First, it's the community aspect. I mean, if you take a visit to, for instance, the Yoga Works website, that's one of the things that they really emphasize, not just the quality of the workout that you're going to get, but the setting that it's in. And if you take a look at some of the other boutiques, that's kind of what they're doing. They're saying that this is not just a place for you to come and work out. It's a place for you to meet a community of people who are like-minded in their approach to fitness or whatever other lifestyle add-ons that people associate with the kind of workout that they choose.
Are they making money?
You know, that's actually a good question, and it's a slightly complicated one. So Yoga Works just recently went public, so this is barely a month going, and they're in the process of expanding. So it's probably a little bit too soon to say yes, they're making money, or no, they're not making money. You know, right now it's just a new company that is, you know, being publicly traded, and a lot of the other ones, let's say like a SoulCycle, they're still private. So you know, it's kind of hard to tell. All that you can see, you know, all that you can tell from is the enthusiasm that there seems to be surrounding the classes, the fact that so many people know about SoulCycle classes and that the studios are showing up in other places is indicative of a level of success.
Market Watch reporter Tanya Garcia with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.com. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend some time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, all the ways Generation X is financially in trouble. Also, a story about signs of life for the circus industry in a post-Ringling Brothers world. And are companies cursed by cameo appearances in the movie Blade Runner? The sequel comes out next month. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, when the month began, a confluence of hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, wildfires, and a brewing international nuclear confrontation already had some Americans thinking about end times. Then, Las Vegas, the nation's playground, witnessed the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Together, they've shadowed a usually optimistic nation with a cloud of sorrow and anxiety. USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson has been taking Americans' pulse. Rick, what have you found?
Well, Gordon, when you think about it, on August 21st, the country experienced the first coast-to-coast solar eclipse since in hundreds of years. And it was just a great moment. Everybody was feeling good about the magnificence of nature and the power of nature. And then today, 6 months later, we just feel overwhelmed, not only by natural catastrophes, but by man-made catastrophes. So the mood has really shifted from one end of the spectrum, I think, to the other in just 6 weeks.
So who's saying what about this? Because I know you kind of weaved in the end of days apocalyptic angle.
Well, I think there's two responses to this idea that this is the end of days. One is to pray to God for help, and the other, maybe related to that, is to attribute to God all these manifestations of his wrath. And to say that it's divine punishment for things that man has done. Those are kind of two separate things. It's also probably a little bit worth just kind of reviewing how we've gotten here, because there's been so much. You've had, in the span of two weeks, two Category 4 hurricanes hit the U.S. mainland, the first time that's ever happened. You've two major earthquakes in Mexico, wildfires in the west devoured an area 50% larger than the state of New Jersey. And then on the man-made front, you have the U.S. and Korea going at each other, increasingly bellicose language. And finally, over the weekend, the president rebukes his own Secretary of State, saying, "You're wasting your time." So I think the result is to make people feel that the end of days might be upon us, and to figure out ways to address that.
Mm. I thought it was poignant to a certain extent. The one woman you quoted on Facebook who wrote, "Oh, well, just another day in a sucky world now." Like she's got this really kind of downer outlook.
Exactly. But she's also divided, because she also says that in the next breath, somehow I want to fix things and make them stop. I think people are really divided over numbing on one hand, and obviously human impulse to care and reach out on the other.
We're speaking with Rick Hampson, national correspondent at USA Today. He's written a piece entitled "Storms, Earthquakes, North Korea, and Now the Las Vegas Massacre." We have to wonder what's next. Anybody take a crack at answering the what's next question?
People are afraid to think about what's next. I think there's some people think this can't continue. I think if you view it as a matter of coincidence, let's take the scientific view, there has to be an end to this. And there are explanations. For instance, storms, well, we're in what is known as hurricane season for a reason. And there hadn't been any such hurricane hit the U.S. mainland in 10 years, 12 years. Earthquakes, Mexico sits on some very unstable tectonic plates. That's just a fact of nature. Mm. And forest fires have been ravaging North America since before any white man or red man arrived here. Korea has been an international sore point since 1953. There was never even an official peace treaty signed to end the Korean War. So there's explanations for all these things. It doesn't necessarily have to come from heaven or hell. And if you think that, you have to think that sooner or later this bad luck has to end.
Thanks, Rick. That's USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. While millennials garner much of the negative press around financial issues, Gen Xers may be the ones who are really in trouble. Katie Hill at Moneyish.com is here to explain the ways Generation X is in financial trouble. Katie, not good.
It's not good. It's not good at all for Gen X. All right, the first one being that there's this new survey out by Allianz Life this week that showed that Gen X has saved exactly the same amount for retirement as millennials have, and they're a lot older. So that is most certainly not good. That was about $35,000, and both the millennials they looked at and the Gen Xers they looked at had both saved the same amount. And as you probably well know, that is way, way, way less than they should have. Fidelity recommends it by 40. You should have three times your salary saved. So anyway you shake it, $35,000 for any member of Gen X is not going to be enough.
Man, and that's the median, meaning half the people are below $35,000.
That's right. And look, I think part of this is that Gen X really is the sandwich generation of, you know, a lot of them have kids. They're also, caring for aging parents. And they feel like retirement is the thing that they can't save for, that they can't do. And so that may be what's going on here. But yeah, I mean, the millennials in this and the Gen Xers in this have saved the same amount. But the Gen Xers are, you know, decade plus younger than some of them. So
boy.
A little bit scary.
Wow. What about the credit card debt? Because that's not a pretty sight either.
No, it is not. Gen X has more credit card debt than any age, old or young, by quite a bit. The 45 to 54 age group has more than $9,000 in credit card debt. The under 35 set's only got about $3,800, and then very much, much older, 75 and up, has the least. But yeah, I mean, Gen X has $9,000 in credit card debt, way more than younger people or older people.
All right, and explain that too, because more broadly, that there's an overall debt load that's kind of plus the credit card debt.
Right. I mean, part of this is that, you know, Gen Xers are a lot more likely to carry mortgages, et cetera. But yes, they have a lot more debt overall, whether it's auto loans, your home loans, credit card debt, than any of the generations. And hopefully, you know, I mean, I'm going to be optimistic about this one. You know, you'll pay it down. Paying a mortgage is often considered good debt, so this could be good. But yeah, their average debt, at least with households with debt in the Gen X, is about $152,000. That's only about $82,000 for the under 35.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. Her piece is called All the Ways Gen X is Financially Wrecked. I mean, is there a reason for hope, or are they stuck?
Oh, I know. I do think there's reason for hope. I think this age, when you have kids and you're aging parents and you're sort of smushed in between that, I mean, other people are going to go through, you know, the millennial generation is probably going to go through this same kind of, you know, spike, and it's going to look a lot like this. You can get out of it, right? You pay off your mortgage and all of a sudden you don't have mortgage payments anymore. Your kids graduate and you're not paying for them anymore. It's just currently for a lot of Gen Xers, they are paying for, you know, kids, college, aging parents, all that's happening right now. And so I think that's why, you know, you see more debt, and you see them kind of way more financially pessimistic, because when you look at that, it's pretty tough to deal with that.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could join us. When the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus shut down earlier this year, ending a nearly century and a half tradition, many wondered if it would mark the death of the circus industry itself. But at the Big E, the show must go on. Wall Street Journal staff writer Charles Pazzi paid a visit to the one in West Springfield, Massachusetts. Charles, what's up here?
Really a fair in New England, the Big E, which is essentially New England State Fair, has kind of led the way over the last several decades with presenting its own circus. But what has happened is now some other state fairs, for example, in Utah and North Carolina, are sort of echoing what the Big E has done and producing their own circuses as well.
Wow. What's the draw? We have no more elephants, obviously.
Well, these circuses still can have animals. That's up to them or whatever. Obviously, you know, that has been a bit of a lightning rod issue. But the draw is that, you know, I think there is still a tremendous appetite in America for circus entertainment. I mean, it's kind of the classic family-friendly entertainment. But with Ringling now ending its run, a lot of cities, a lot of towns will not have that annual visit from the circus. So the state fairs can essentially fill that void. For the state fairs, anything they can do that will get people into the fair is a good idea. Essentially, these circuses are usually offered as a free attraction at the fair, and the circuses will typically run for the whole duration at the fair. And, you know, it's an inducement to get people to come out to the fair.
Are the fairs doing things differently these days in a post-Ringling world?
Well, I think in general what the fairs are doing is presenting a much smaller style of circus, a one-ring circus with just a handful of acts. So at the Big E, I think it's about six or seven acts. And these are hour-long shows. They're not, you know, the Ringling full-scale three-ring, two-hour-plus show. So these are compact shows. For the fairs, that makes sense because it's also much more cost-effective to do it that way. But yeah, I mean, in a sense, if you're looking for the spectacle of the three-ring, you will not get that. On the other hand, you know, people often feel that a one-ring circus is a better experience. It's more up close, it's more intimate, a little bit more intense, if you will. So there has been, and that's actually been a movement that's been going on for a while. The Big Apple Circus in New York has presented essentially a one-ring show. So this is what the state fairs are doing, but it's not exactly the Ringling model.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal staff writer Charles Pazzi about his story entitled Signs of Life for the Circus Industry at the State Fair. How about the cost of these things?
Well, they're not cheap necessarily. They are cheaper than doing a Ringling show. The Big E folks wouldn't share the exact cost with us, but they said it's in the six figures and a significant portion of their entertainment budget, which was $2.3 million. On the other hand, state fairs have really been challenged. The typical entertainment at state fairs has been musical entertainment and often high-profile stars and often high-profile country music stars. Well, over time, time in the concert industry, the road, the touring acts, the touring has become much more important with the record industry tanking. So a lot of acts have basically upped their prices. So state fairs that might have paid $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for an act are now paying $100,000 to $500,000. So even though the circus might be an expensive proposition, you know, if they're pouring, let's just say for the sake of argument, $500,000 into a circus, but it runs over the course of the 17-day fair or the 12-day fair, that might actually be cheaper than hiring three country acts. So they're finding that the math is working out in their favor, but it should be clear that putting on any kind of circus is not a cheap endeavor.
Thanks, Charles. That's Wall Street Journal staff writer Charles Pazzi in New York. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. If you want to connect with us on social media, you can do so on Facebook. We're on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show, and you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username at Gordon Deal.
I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain.
With the new Blade Runner movie out this weekend called Blade Runner 2049, marketers will be watching for a curse that came along with businesses featured in the 1982 original. The original corporate curse was widespread. The Wall Street Journal says Atari, whose logo shines on the street behind actor Harrison Ford in the original film, held an 80% share of the home video game market in 1982. Within a year of its cameo, the company was dumping truckloads of unsold games into a landfill in New Mexico, victim of a massive industry slump. Headphone maker Koss, featured on an electronics store in the original Blade Runner, filed for Chapter 11 in 1984. Shortly after its appearance, food processor pioneer Cuisinart settled a price-fixing lawsuit and eventually landed in bankruptcy court. RCA and Bell Telephone, whose logos got screen time in the 1982 film, ceased to exist. Corporate signage, by the way, is a design element in Blade Runner 2049. Brands to watch after they appear in the current movie: Johnny Walker Whiskey, Sony, Peugeot, and Coca-Cola, which actually survived the first Blade Runner. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.